nudge from JFK, they discovered something odd about Harry's paranoia. It turns out it had been pointed in every direction except where it would have been deserved, at his own department. Immediately after he finally stood down, an investigation by a special team from the Internal Revenue Service found that the Bureau was so riddled with corrupt agents that, as the historian John McWilliams put it, the Bureau itself was actually the major source of supply and protector of heroin in the United States. Anslinger had been too busy chasing doctors, jazz singers, addicts, and Chinese dragons to see there were drug dealers all around him. But no matter. Harry had won. By the time he left office, as the only man ever to run a U.S. security agency longer than J. Edgar Hoover, nobody was suggesting disbanding the Federal Bureau of Narcotics anymore. It was an essential part of the government machine. Years later, in 1970, Playboy magazine arranged a roundtable debate of the drug laws and invited him to take part. For the first time since he sat down with Henry Smith Williams in the 1930s, Harry Anslinger was forced to defend his arguments against articulate opponents. They included the psychiatrist Dr. Joel Fort, the lawyer Joseph Otteri, and the poet laureate of narcotics, William Burroughs. This time, Harry did not run away from defending his views, as he had with Henry Smith Williams. He went on the attack. "A person under the influence of marijuana," he declared, "can get so violent that it takes about 5 policemen to hold him down." He said there is proof that continued use of hashish results in commitment to mental hospitals. Before, he would have been greeted with a respectful silence. Not now. When asked for evidence for these claims, he talked about the Indian psychiatrist Dr. Isaac Chopra, who has stated flatly and unequivocally that cannabis drugs lead to psychosis. "I got Dr. Chopra on the stand in Boston, under cross-examination," Otteri replied, "and he admitted his studies did not involve a valid scientific sample, and didn't really connect marijuana and insanity in any cause-and-effect fashion." Anslinger had no response. His opponents offered studies, facts, figures about how prohibition had not worked. Anslinger kept coming back with anecdotes, almost always sexual. "I can tell you about a case in a fraternity house where they were having a weekend party. On a dare, one of the girls took a sugar cube in which there was a drop of LSD. She was out for 2 days. And during that time, she was raped by a number of the fraternity boys." The other people around the table seemed nonplussed, as sexy stories adapted from the pages of 1930s pulp fiction bumped up against valid scientific studies. It's as if a Mickey Spillane detective had wandered into a medical seminar and started telling the doctors they were talking bunk, because one time he'd followed a blonde dame down an alleyway. Anslinger started to try to compete with their world of factual claims, saying, "I challenge you to name one doctor who has reported a beneficial effect of marijuana outside of the backward areas of the world." He was immediately answered with names. Dr. Lloyd J. Thompson, professor of psychiatry at Bowman Gray School of Medicine, and George T. Stocking, one of Britain's leading psychiatrists. Again, Anslinger had no response. This kept happening in a strange foxtrot of debunking. Anslinger asserted, the experts rebutted, Anslinger fell silent. When feeling met fact, he was stumped. And then Anslinger snapped. He started calling everybody at the table around him utterly monstrous, and said they were talking vicious tripe, and must have a disordered mind. Then he compared them to Adolf Hitler, and finally spluttered, "We've been hearing some of the most ridiculous statements that have ever been made." As I sat amid boxes and boxes of Harry's papers, all that remains of him, except for a global war, I found something sad about this scene. He was clearly an old man in pain, both from the angina he had developed and from no longer having the power to silence this conversation. Still, he tried, raising the rhetorical stakes to claim that the people who disagree with him will cause the death of America. "History is strewn," he said, "with the bones of nations that have tolerated moral laxity and hedonism." Dr. Fort looked over at Anslinger's vast, bald head and replied, "You have led this country to treat scientific questions," he said, "the way such matters were handled in the Middle Ages." Dr. Henry Smith Williams had said this at the beginning of Anslinger's long career. Now another doctor was standing before him, saying precisely the same thing, as Harry Anslinger offered his last recorded words. Chapter 4 The Bullet at the Birth. As I dug deeper, I realized there was a hole in the story of the start of the drug war, a large and cavernous one. It's impossible to piece together how this all began through the eyes of the cops, the doctors, and the addicts. But, as I read on, I found they were all obsessed with a fourth force, the new army of drug dealers that was emerging all around them. I wanted to know their stories, how they saw the world. But drug dealers don't keep records. There's no National Heroin Dealers Archive to consult. For a long time, no matter how hard I looked, it seemed as this was a tale that could never be retrieved. Their memories died with the people who knew them, and they're all gone now. But then I found out there was one exception. The first man to really see the potential of drug dealing in America was a gangster named Arnold Rothstein, and I slowly realized it was possible to piece him back together in quite a lot of detail. He was so egotistical, he actually invited journalists to write about him, and he was so powerful he didn't worry about the police reading it. He owned them. There have been a number of biographies written of him, and even more important, I found out that after he died, his wife wrote a detailed memoir of her life with him, explaining exactly what he was like, in lush, novelistic detail. There was only one problem. Every copy of his wife's memoir seemed to have disappeared. Even the copy at the New York Public Library had vanished sometime in the 1970s. I eventually tracked down what seems to be the only remaining copy in the Library of Congress, so I sat there in the shadow of the Senate and tried to reconstruct him piece by piece. This is the story I found of how Arnold taught the world to deal drugs. In the mid-1920s, Arnold Rothstein would stand on a street corner by the flickering neon crush of Times Square, waiting for someone, anyone, who owed him money, to walk by. The streets of the city were thick with people in hock to Rothstein, and, like Anslinger, he could make people afraid just by looking at them. At first glance, though, it was harder to see why. He was 5'7", pale and baby-faced, with small feminine hands. He never fidgeted, or drank, or raised a fist. He refused even to chew gum. He was sober and smart to the last thread of his perfectly tailored suits, but everybody in New York City knew that Rothstein could have you killed just by snapping his fingers, and that he had bought so many NYPD cops and politicians that he would never be punished for it. Rothstein's wife, a Broadway chorus girl named Carolyn, had a habit of driving past, and she would call out to him. But she, too, was afraid. Later, she would write, "Often, on my way home in a car, I would have myself driven slowly up Broadway, past 47th to 50th Street. It might be a cold night, or a rainy one, or it might be snowing. But more often than not, Arnold would be there. I would ask him to come home. He would shake his head and say, 'I'm waiting to see someone to collect from.' He would stay out in all kinds of weather to collect small sums, even amounts as low as $50. yet he might have made thousands that same day. The amounts, it always seemed to me, were not what counted so much with Arnold, as the percentages. He was playing with chips, and the chips must show a profit. It was the height of the jazz age, and Arnold Rothstein was the most feared man in New York City. After he had shaken down enough cash from people for the day, he would sit until long after dawn in Lindy's, a cafe in the throng of Times Square, and orchestrate his network of fraud, theft, and extortion. At the tables around him were the members of the Manhattan underworld and overworld huddled together, actors and songwriters, boxers and their managers, columnists and communists, cops and criminals. Carolyn said it was like a waterhole in the jungle, where beasts of prey and their natural enemies gather under a very real but invisible flag of truce for refreshment. On one of these nights, at a table nearby, two men were writing a musical whose main characters were based on Arnold and Carolyn. They were going to call it Guys and Dolls. The musical would be funny. Arnold, though, was not. When he laughed, everyone thought it was strangely artificial. I learned that when he laughed, the laughter was a surface demonstration, a combination of the movement of face muscles synchronized with a sound, counterfeiting, but not partaking of, hilarity. Carolyn recalled years later. But to us, Arnold matters most for just one reason. He was about to be handed the biggest black market in history. Nobody could understand how Arnold got this way. His father, who had witnessed his toddler son standing over his sleeping brother with a knife, was one of the most beloved men in Manhattan's Jewish community. Avraham Rothstein's family had fled vicious anti-Jewish mobs in Russia for the Lower East Side in the 1880s. Avraham started out sewing caps, then worked his way up in the garment trade, and eventually became a wealthy cotton goods dealer. If you had a problem in the Orthodox Jewish community, you'd come to him, and he would adjudicate. He was so scrupulously fair, they called him Abe the Just. They would call his son a lot of things, but never just. Even as a small boy, Arnold had one marked quality beyond his coldness, an astonishing ability with mathematics. He could manipulate numbers and odds in a way that startled people. From the age of 12, he knew that his father wouldn't dream of carrying cash from the setting of the sun on Friday night to the end of the Sabbath the next day, so Arnold stole the money from his wallet, played craps, and won so often and so big, he could always replace the cash without anyone's noticing. By the time he ran away from home at 17 to be a traveling salesman, Arnold knew he could crack card games better than anyone else. He was starting to regard himself as a superman, far above the dumb herd, explaining later, "There are 2 billion fools for one brainy man." He was the brainy man, and he was going to get his due from the fools. And the brain, as he now insisted on being called, soon discovered the greatest truth of gambling. The only way to win every time is to own the casino. So he set up a series of underground gambling dens across New York City, and when they got busted, one after another, he invented the floating craps game. A never-ending craps chute that skipped from shadowy venue to dusky basement across the island. He carried the cash on him, up to $100,000 at a time, and he obsessively counted the money by hand, again and again. He had a tactile relationship with cash. The crinkle of banknotes was his music and his muse. He took no pleasure from the games themselves, only the end result. Even after years spent at racetracks, he couldn't tell one horse from the other. He knew only their statistics and the cash that would whir his way at the end. No matter how much money he had, Rothstein always believed he was behind and had to find a way to make more. When he first met his future wife, Carolyn, at a friend's party, he said he was a sporting man. I thought that a sporting man was one who hunted and shot, she wrote. It wasn't until later I learned all a sporting man hunted was a victim with money, and all he shot was craps. On the night of their wedding, he told her he would need to pawn her engagement ring to free up funds, and she handed it over without complaining. He guarded his money without a smile. One day, a gambler Rothstein knew called him long distance. He said he was broke and desperately needed $500 to get back to New York and back in the game. "I can't hear you," Arnold said into the phone. The gambler kept repeating his request. "I can't hear you," Arnold repeated. The caller fiddled with his phone until the operator interrupted. "But Mr. Rothstein, I can hear him distinctly," she said. "All right," Arnold replied. "Then you give it to him," and hung up. He was used to rigging bets. "I knew my limitations when I was 15 years old, and since that time I never played any game with a man I knew I couldn't beat," he said. At the racetrack, he would pay jockeys to throw the race, and gradually, year by year, he took this to a higher level. The bets got bigger, and his winnings got more improbable, until he finally reached the biggest, most-watched, and most adrenaline-soaked game in America, the World Series. 50 million Americans were listening in 1919 when, against all the odds and every prediction, the Cincinnati Reds beat the far-and-away favorites, the White Sox. Long after the gasps were silent and the stadium was full only of echoes, the reason emerged. Rothstein had paid 8 White Sox players to throw the match. All 8 players were charged with fraud, and all were mysteriously acquitted. In accounts of Arnold's story, I found that word appearing again and again, mysteriously. A man like Arnold Rothstein would always have been able to ferret out some criminal opportunity, but Arnold was handed 2 of the largest industries in America, tax-free. He immediately spotted that the prohibition of booze and drugs was the biggest lottery win for gangsters in history. There will always be large numbers of people who want to get drunk or high, and if they can't do it legally, they will do it illegally. "Prohibition is going to last a long time, and then one day it'll be abandoned," Rothstein told his associates. "But it's going to be with us for quite a while, that's for sure. I can see that more and more people are going to ignore the law, and we can make a fortune meeting this need." Under Prohibition, dealers were starting to discover you can sell whatever crap you want. Who's going to complain to the police that they were poisoned by your illicit booze? Outbreaks of mass alcohol poisoning spread across America. In one incident alone, 500 people were permanently crippled in Wichita, Kansas. But the market for illegal alcohol would live on for 13 years, and then Franklin Roosevelt, desperate for new sources of tax revenue, would make it legal again in 1933. The greater gift, Rothstein saw, was in the market for drugs. They surely would stay banned far into the future. At first, the street peddlers had controlled the trade. They got their supply in one of 2 ways, by staging heists of legal opiates as they were delivered to hospitals, or by ordering in bulk from legal suppliers in Mexico or Canada under fake company names. In 1922, Congress cracked down on this. Rothstein saw that these small-time crooks were missing the bigger opportunity anyway. This, he concluded, was a task for industrial manufacturing and industrial-scale smuggling. He sent his men to buy in bulk in Europe, where factories could still legally make heroin, shipped it over, and then distributed it to street sellers across New York and beyond. For his system to work, Rothstein had to invent the modern drug gang. There had been gangs in New York City for generations, but they were small-time hoodlums who spent most of their energy beating each other up. Arnold's gangs were as disciplined as military units, and he made sure they had only one passion, the bottom line. That is how, by the mid-1920s, Rothstein and his new species of New York gang controlled the entire trade in heroin and cocaine on the eastern seaboard of the United States. We need to freeze the frame here for a moment. As Arnold stands by Times Square in the afternoon of the Jazz Age, looking for people who owe him money. At this moment, the heroin clinics are being shut down by the Federal Bureau of Narcotics across the United States. This is a hinge point in history. It is the moment when the control of drugs is transferred to the most dangerous people. As the result of the Harrison Act and its subsequent hardline interpretation by Harry's Bureau, it is passing from Henry Smith Williams and his colleagues to Arnold Rothstein and his thugs. It wasn't by the law of nature. It was by political decree. When it came to addicts, Rothstein was as repulsed as Anslinger. The day he found one of his associates sucking on an opium pipe, he threw him out. But it's not hard to see why Arnold stuck with his new trade. The World newspaper reported, "For every $1,000 spent in purchasing opium, smuggling it into the country and dispensing it, those at the top of the pyramid collect $6,000 or more in profit." Arnold soon discovered that when you control the massive revenue offered by the drug industry, individual police and politicians are easy to buy. His profit margins were so vast, he could outbid the salaries cops earned from the state. "The police," a journalist wrote in 1929, "were as gracious to him as they were to a police commissioner." This is why every time Arnold Rothstein was caught committing violence, the charges mysteriously vanished. Arnold tamed the police with an approach that, years later, would be distilled by his successors, the Mexican drug cartels, into a single elegant phrase, plato o plomo, silver or lead. Take our bribe, or take our bullet. Every now and then, there would be a police officer who refused to accept these ground rules. When two detectives, John Walsh and Josh McLaughlin, broke into one of Rothstein's illegal dens one night, he shot at them, suspecting they were robbers. The judge dismissed the case. A journalist asked, "What's a little pistol practice with policemen as targets when you're Arnold Rothstein?" He did to law enforcement what he did to the World Series. He turned it into a performance the watching public believed was real, when it was in fact a puppet show. Enough of the players on the field worked for him to guarantee his success every time. But no matter how rich he got, he lived exactly the same way, eating at Lindy's late into every night. There was only one luxury he allowed himself. He paid a dentist to remove every one of his teeth and inserted shiny white ones in their place. At some point, Arnold began to kill. This is where the camera lens of history becomes misted up, and it gets harder to see what really happened. For obvious reasons, nobody recorded the names and details of Arnold's victims. We can only infer that they existed through hints here and there. Everyone, even hardcore gangsters, was terrified of him. We know you don't get that reputation only through wisecracks. There is only one of Rothstein's likely victims whose name is traceable now. The biographer David Petrusa was able to dig it up, and that is because the victim was the third richest man in the world. One day, Arnold met in a hotel on East 42nd Street with Captain Alfred Löwenstein, a financier so rich that when the Germans seized Belgium during World War I, Löwenstein reputedly offered to buy it back with his own cash. With Rothstein, the captain signed the biggest drug deal in history up to that point, a plan to mass-market a range of opiates to a growing new market. Soon after making the pact, he got on his private plane and flew to Europe. When the plane landed, Captain Löwenstein was not on board. The staff said he had gone to the toilet and had not come back. The New York Times reported that it was practically impossible to open such a door if the plane were flying at ordinary cruising speed. Presumably, whatever Rothstein got in the deal up front, he kept. As I pieced together Arnold's story in the shadow of the Capitol, I kept thinking of all the dry sociological studies I'd been reading about the drug war, and they began to make sense. They explain that when a popular product is criminalized, it does not disappear. Instead, criminals start to control the supply and sale of the product. They have to get it into the country, transport it to where it's wanted, and sell it on the street. At every stage, the product is vulnerable. If somebody comes along and steals it, they can't go to the police or the courts to get it back. So they can only defend the property one way, by violence. But you don't want to be having a shootout every day. That's no way to run a business. So you have to establish a reputation. A reputation for being terrifying. People must believe that you are so violent and brutal that they are too afraid to even try to pick a fight with you. You can only establish that reputation with attention-grabbing acts of brutality. The French sociologist Philippe Bourgois would give this process a name. A culture of terror. But the first person to notice and begin to articulate this dynamic was a half-drunk, nicotine-encrusted tabloid journalist, Donald Henderson Clark, whose beat was to hang out in bars from Midtown to the Bowery with Rothstein and his fellow thugs. "It is hard," he wrote, "to convey the fear with which Rothstein was regarded. Get in bad with a police commissioner, or a district attorney, or a governor, or anyone like that, and you figure out with a fair degree of certainty what might happen to you on the basis of what you had done. Get in bad with Arnold Rothstein, and all the figuring in the world wouldn't get you anywhere. It's true that nothing might happen to you but fear. But that's an awful calamity to come upon any man." Arnold's men sprayed bullets across the city with the cheerful abandon of wedding guests tossing confetti. One of his chief henchmen, Jack Legs Diamond, was on the receiving end of so much return fire he was nicknamed the Human Ammunition Dump for the Underworld. But Rothstein and his men seemed always to come out on top, and as a result, nobody dared to cross them. One day, Arnold was on the subway when some anonymous pickpocket silently stole his pearl stickpin, the only personal adornment he had ever loved. Over dinner, with his mirthless laugh, he explained to some other gangsters how he'd been robbed. "Me, the wise guy. What do you think of that?" The next day, a package arrived at his house. It contained the stickpin and a note reading, "The guy who took it didn't know who you were." While Arnold spread his terror, his wife, Carolyn, was virtually a prisoner in his house. He forbade her from going out after 6 p.m., or to be contacted by anyone. He said it was because the police were constantly watching. He controlled everything about her. He ordered her not to bob her hair, saying she would lose all dignity if she did. At night, she recalled in her memoir, she would sit up listening to the roulette wheel from the underground gambling parlor her husband ran across the street. She could figure out if the house was winning by listening to whether the croupier was speedily raking in the chips or more slowly counting them out. As she waited up for him, the fragment of a memory from years ago kept coming back to Carolyn. When she was a dancer, she had cha-cha'd all over the country in a comedy show called The Chorus Lady. Once, on a train chugging through Pennsylvania, or maybe Kansas, she forgot the precise location, she had seen a long, lazy row of country houses, lit only by the flickering kerosene lamps inside. She tried to picture the lives of the people inside, calm and cool and safe. Arnold came home every morning, around 5 or 6, and immediately indulged his only addiction, glugging quarts of milk and eating trays of cakes in a frenzy. A giant leather screen hung in front of the windows to block out the light. He woke at 3 in the afternoon and always groaned the same thing. "I don't feel well." He had a headache, or indigestion. His repressed way, perhaps, of dealing with what he must have known, that he could be killed at any moment. He always promised Carolyn he would get out once he had enough, but she slowly realized there would never be enough for him. Besides, if he let go of the reins of violence for even a moment, he would be killed by the Rothstein wannabes jostling in the alleys of Broadway. Any sign of weakness would mean a bullet in an alleyway. "It's too late. I can't do it," he told her. "I've gotten into it, and I can't get out of it." He'd always been freakishly fearless. One day, a gunman shoved a revolver into his stomach and demanded he hand over $500. "When you get $500 out of me, you'll need it to pay your funeral expenses with," he said. "Now think that over." Yet beginning around 1926, something happened to Rothstein, and for the first time in his life, he seemed afraid. He was told that there was a serious threat to his life, and not long after, a man roughly the same height and appearance as Rothstein left his building. He was met by 2 gun-toting men who told him to get into their car. It was only after they had taken the man several blocks that they cursed, "We got the wrong man." One night, not long after that, Arnold woke Carolyn up, ashen-faced. "I have just had a terrible experience," he said. He had arrived at their apartment building and tried the door, but it was locked. "I rang the bell and knew it was sounding because I could hear it. Then I saw the elevator man lying on the couch. I thought he was bound and gagged." Arnold ran several blocks to find a policeman, but when they returned, the door opened easily. Nothing was wrong. Everything was in its place, except Arnold's nerve. He was losing it. In 1927, a car he used was found riddled with machine gun bullets as it waited for him outside the Hotel Fairfield on West 72nd Street. Not long after that, Carolyn asked for a divorce. He knew what was coming, and so, in the end, it did. Arnold Rothstein was 47 years old. When he staggered into the service entrance of the Park Central Hotel on 56th Street at 10:50 p.m., on November 5th, 1928. The brain had taken a bullet to the gut. "Get me a taxi," he said. When the cops came instead and asked who did it, he mumbled, "If I live, I'll tend to it. If I die, the gang will." It took him more than a day to die in a hospital in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn. As he lay there semi-comatose, his lawyer and his mistress, a 27-year-old chorus girl, another one, named Inez Norton, guided his hand to write a new will. They thought they would inherit a fortune, but in fact, once his endless shuffling of money was picked apart, it turned out Arnold's massive running debts exceeded his assets, and his lawyer and mistress got nothing. As it happened, Rothstein had taken out a fresh $50,000 life insurance policy the Saturday before. The check hadn't reached the company. The payment was never made. The police didn't want to investigate the murder. They didn't want to lift the lid and unleash on themselves all the criminal and official forces swirling around Rothstein's corpse. It was as if no one, lawman or criminal, wanted to be close to this murder in any way. Rothstein's biographer, Nick Toshes, wrote. Eventually, a rival gambler named George McManus was charged with the murder, but he was acquitted by the jury. From then, Tosches says, until today, the mystery has grown. Speculation has run and roamed wildly in a desire to identify not only the hand that pulled the trigger, but also the interplay of hidden forces that controlled the hand. It was only a year after I first learned about this, on the streets of the deadliest city in the world, Ciudad Juarez, that I realized the significance of that moment. This was the bullet at the birth of drug prohibition, and nobody knows where it came from, even now. It's like the bullet that claimed the Archduke Ferdinand at the start of the First World War, the first shot in a global massacre. Rothstein's domination of the East Coast drug trade shattered as that trigger was pulled. From that moment on, drug dealers would be engaged in a constant conflict to control the distribution of drugs. The drug war analyst, Charles Bowden, says there are, in reality, two drug wars going on. There is the war on drugs, where the state wages war on the users and addicts, and then there is the war for drugs, where the criminals fight each other to control the trade. The war for drugs was launched in earnest in the Park Central Hotel in Manhattan, as Arnold Rothstein lay bleeding. There would be many more bullets, but I was going to learn on my journey that Arnold Rothstein has not yet died. Every time he is killed, a harder and more vicious version of him emerges to fill the space provided by prohibition for a global criminal industry. Arnold Rothstein is the start of a lineup of criminals that runs through the Crips and the Bloods and Pablo Escobar to Chapo Guzman, each more vicious because he was strong enough to kill the last. As Harry Anslinger wrote in 1961, "One group rose to power over the corpses of another." It is Darwinian evolution, armed with a machine gun and a baggie of crack. And I was going to see that, like Rothstein, Harry Anslinger is reincarnated in ever tougher forms, too. Before this war is over, his successors were going to be deploying gunships along the coasts of America, imprisoning more people than any other society in human history, and spraying poisons from the air across foreign countries thousands of miles away from home to kill their drug crops. The key players in the war continued to be either Anslingers or Rothsteins, the prohibitionist and the gangster, locked together in a tango unto the far horizon. The policy of prohibition summoned these characters into existence because it needs them. So long as it lives, they live. The scream that tore through Harry Anslinger, the bullet that tore through Arnold Rothstein, and the laws that tore through Edward Williams' medical practice, they are part of all our lives, whether we have a direct relationship to illegal drugs or not. To see how that came to be, 70 years later, I travelled from city to city and realized I'd come to understand these dynamics best through the stories of three people. One was trying to be Arnold Rothstein, one was trying to be Harry Anslinger, and one was sitting outside on her porch, playing with a doll. Part 2. Ghosts. Chapter 5. Souls of Mischief. I closed the files on Harry and Arnold and Billy and resolved to find myself a drug dealer. I wanted to see how the dynamics set in train by these men so long ago were playing out today, not only in academic papers or in polemics about the drug war, but on the actual street corners of New York City, where Arnold fought and Billy died. The scraps left to history can only get you so far. It was time for me to watch the drug war's history unfold in real time. A friend of mine, who works in drug policy reform in New York, gave me the number of a person called Chino Hardin. "Go meet him," he said. "Nobody can explain it better." I first met Chino outside a diner in Greenwich Village. He walked into my life smoking, and he has been smoking almost continuously ever since. His hair was tied back tightly, and a bright bandana covered his head. He was wearing a big, baggy sweater with the Incredible Hulk on it. He was waving his big green fist at the world. His voice, I noticed, was deep and husky. We took our seats in the diner, and Chino watched me carefully as I told him what I wanted to know, how drug dealing works from the inside. I couldn't tell if he was suspicious or anxious, but I was aware he was sizing me up. And then he said to me, quite abruptly, as if he had made a decision, "I grew up in East Flatbush, Brooklyn. I was born in Kings County Hospital, down the road from my house." And from that starting point, in interview after interview, we talked through the story of his life. We would continue talking about it for 3 years, and counting. I found out later that Chino was transitioning to living as a man, and considering gender reassignment surgery. At his request, I referred to him throughout this book with masculine pronouns, even though he was regarded as a woman by the people around him and by the legal system for most of this time period, because he always felt, inside, that he was male. On that first afternoon, I noted that Chino spoke very fast and in a rhythm, as though there was always a beat behind him that I couldn't quite hear. But after a while, I felt I began to hear the beat. It was one of the many things Chino has taught me. Almost 70 years after Arnold Rothstein stood on his street corner in New York City, waiting for a pile of cash to walk on by, Chino had, he explained, been doing just the same. Like him, he scared people just by being there. He had a pit bull by his side, and gold fangs attached to his teeth. His hair was pulled back into a baseball cap, and in the brim he had stashed little baggies of crack. Hidden nearby, in a trash can, he kept his gun, a 9mm Smith & Wesson. He had a crew called the Souls of Mischief, and they did what he said, when he said. He was 14 years old. "Are you holding?" his customers would ask as they drove up. "Yeah, I'm holding," he would reply. He stood at the junction of East 38th Street and Church Avenue in East Flatbush, a slum stretch of Brooklyn. The brand names of Manhattan vanish this far out, leaving only small businesses with names like Michael's Prime Meats, White Sheep Laundry, and endless 99-cent stores, broken only by evangelical churches promising the path to salvation. The houses must have looked new and glossy when they first rose in the 1950s, but they seem to have been slowly sighing back into the earth ever since. Chino's crack came in white slivers that looked like chips of soap. At first he stashed them in his mouth, but they made his cheek and tongue go numb. Then he held them in his hand, but they started to dissolve, and nobody wanted to buy that. So he learned you had to get creative. He sometimes stuck them under a nearby parked car, attached to a magnet. Later, he got a collar for his pit bull, Rocky, and kept the crack in his collar. "So Rocky sold crack, too," he laughed. But on that day, and the endless days like it, they were in his cap and up for sale. There was once only one Arnold Rothstein in New York City. In the 7 decades of escalating warfare ever since, there has come to be an Arnold Rothstein on every block in every poor neighborhood in America. The fragmentation that began with the bullet to Rothstein's gut had continued to this block in Brooklyn on this day. Chino went out onto his corner, selling whether it snowed or rained or the sun shone down. It was the only route to riches he could see in this neighborhood, and the only way to be safe. He knew that would seem strange to outsiders. How does becoming a gangster make you safe? But looking out over his block as a kid, he concluded that in East Flatbush, in the crosshairs of both the war on drugs and the war for drugs, you have to feed, or you will be food. You could see the souls of mischief on the corner. Chino and four of his homies, all boys. Chino was the unquestioned top dog. When Chino said move, they moved. When Chino said go, they'd go. They were entirely obedient. They watched his anger and aggression with awe, as if he was not a person, but an electrical storm with skin. Even then he dressed as a boy and acted like a boy. They called him Jason. They knew he was biologically a woman at that point, but they treated him as a man. And he was careful to be twice as brave just to underline it. He never told his crew to do anything he wouldn't do himself. He would always get his hands dirty with you. If the crew had to attack, he would be at the front. And sometimes it was necessary to attack. Their crew was part of a wider network called Brooklyn's Most Wanted, who controlled the 30s in Flatbush. He got his drugs from Peter, a guy in his 20s from Chino's block, and he answered to him. Peter first approached him when Chino was 13, asking if he wanted to make a lot of cash. He explained, "You take the bags, you work the corner, you keep up to $500 a week." After that, everybody knew he was under Peter's protection. You couldn't touch him without retaliation from Peter, and he was one of the three or four biggest dealers between Utica and Flatbush. It meant Chino had power, and respect, and a name, and as much freedom from fear as he would ever get. And money. He would spend the money on going to the movies, treating his friends, buying clothes he would wear only once. And he spent a lot of time at Coney Island, riding the cyclone, or playing Mortal Kombat. To protect this way of life, you have to be terrifying. As we learned under Rothstein, you can't go to the police to protect your property or your trade. You have to defend it yourself, with guns and testosterone. If you ever crack and show some flicker of compassion, he tells me years later, everybody's gonna fucking rob you. They'll just move in on your turf, take over your block, do whatever they want to you. You have to be fucked up to survive in this fucked up paradigm. You gotta be violent to not have violence done to you. You set examples. You make examples out of people. Some of them are completely justified and called for. A lot of them are not. So the crew shot at trees, shot in the air, killed animals. Sometimes Chino would shoot in the direction of people, rival crews he needed to scare shitless. He will tell me that his bullets never hit them. He will also tell me there are things you can never tell anyone. Sometimes the gun jammed and everyone else was too frightened to unjam it. Not Chino. I would cock that bitch back, he says. Let that bullet come out, put it back in the clip, and put the clip back in. Two of their rival gangs were called the Autobots and the Decepticons, after the Transformer toys that were popular at the time and that they still played with. These child soldiers lived in a mental landscape they constructed from scraps of TV cartoons, hip-hop, and a policy decision that handed them a crucial place on the delivery line of one of the biggest industries in the world. One time, some older men arrived on the block to try to claim it as theirs. Gina remembers it this way. We had some cats come through, some older cats. We welcomed them, smoked with them, laughed with them. Basically, they were trying to son us. That is, treat them like kids, like their sons. Tell us what to do, as if we didn't have our own set. Some altercation happened between them and one of my soldiers, and before you know it, we was beating their ass. We jumped them and beat the shit out of them. We hit them with bottles, garbage cans, and we let them run out of the neighborhood and told them to never come back. About this need to defend his teenage crew against older aggressors, he says, it's almost like in the animal kingdom. In our minds, it's no different. They thought they were bigger, older lions. But we're not necessarily lions. We're like packs of hyenas. If you're going to play by animal kingdom rules, you got to know the right animal. This violence was taken for granted in the neighborhood. If you don't hear a gunshot, one resident told a reporter in 1993. You're amazed at the quiet. It wasn't only rival gangs that Chino had to discipline with violence. It was his own soldiers. His number two, his right hand, was named Smokey, a Jamaican boy from his block. One day Smokey started a fight with some Crips, one of the main gangs in the United States, outside Chino's house, because he wanted to establish that this was unequivocally their turf. They owned it, and they commanded respect on it. "Who the fuck is that talking loud on my block?" he demanded of them. "Yo! You just screw the fuck up," they spat, taunting him. Suddenly, Chino saw Smokey had picked a fight he couldn't win. They were getting into his face, and they outnumbered him. So he had to step in, only to find he had created a situation where... I can't be diplomatic. That would be a sign of fucking weakness. He told Smokey to take his knife and go slash them, to prove nobody could mess with this crew or their trade. But they just laughed at the knife. They snatched the gold chain from his neck, and Smokey lost his nerve and ran. Chino knew that this situation was potentially fatal for his crew and its reputation. If they could humiliate his number two, the next step would be to humiliate him and take his patch. He would be left with nothing. Carolyn Rothstein said about Arnold, "He never failed to fashion a punishment for the one who had offended against his omniscience." He must do the same. His pit bull was growling at them, but the dog couldn't do much. Rocky had all the heart, but not a lot of the equipment. They were smelling fear. Chino pulled a knife. He had to show them, in a slash, that he would use it, if he needed to. Suddenly he got sucker-punched, and everything went woozy. But he had made his point. His crew wouldn't just run in the face of threats. They would fight, even when it was a girl up against two guys. But now Chino had to deal with Smokey. He had pulled the crew into danger and then vanished. When he skulked toward Chino after it was all over, he claimed he had run to get a gun to defend them. But Chino couldn't make allowances for cowardice, not here. The crew took him to 235 Park nearby, a grassy patch, and poured water on his shirt. Then Chino took off his belt, and he lashed Smokey 31 times. That was the standard first phase of punishment for cowardice. Then he had to embark on the second phase. He had to go find the opposing set and slash one of them. Smokey staggered off, but something went wrong. He didn't slash a rival. Terrorized and half-crazed and hyped, he looked for anyone he could attack, and he slashed an old man in a store, which isn't what Chino wanted at all. Soon he was back in prison. Chino was furious. The point he needed to be made was that his set was strong, and nobody should ever try and fuck with them, or take their drugs, or mock their status. By attacking an old person, he says, he actually made us look weaker. That was the careful balance of terror he had to negotiate every day. For Chino, the war on drugs was not a metaphor. It was a battlefield onto which he woke and on which he slept. He explains, "I can live with you breaking my heart, but I can't live with you making other people think I'm weak. I literally can't live with that, because then they come for me." I would leave my meetings about Chino and pore over academic studies and explanations of the drug market, trying to see how this fitted into the story he was telling me. Slowly I began to see the patterns underlying it. When we hear about drug-related violence, we picture somebody getting high and killing people. We think the violence is the product of the drugs. But in fact, it turns out this is only a tiny sliver of the violence. The vast majority is like Chino's violence, to establish, protect, and defend drug territory in an illegal market. and to build a name for being consistently terrifying so nobody tries to take your property or turf. Professor Paul Goldstein of the University of Illinois conducted a detailed study in which he and his team looked at every killing identified as drug-related in New York City in 1986. It turned out 7.5% of the killings took place after a person took drugs and their behavior seemed to change. Some 2% were the result of addicts trying to steal to feed their habit and it going wrong. And more than 3/4, the vast majority, were like Chino's attacks. They weren't caused by drugs, any more than Al Capone's killings were caused by alcohol. They were, Goldstein showed, caused by prohibition. Just as the war on alcohol created armed gangs fighting to control the booze trade, the war on drugs has created armed gangs fighting and killing to control the drug trade. The National Youth Gang Center has discovered that youth gangs, like the Souls of Mischief, are responsible for between 23 and 45% of all drug sales in the United States. I discussed this one afternoon with Chino, and he nodded. He explained the gang didn't exist only to sell drugs, but it gives the gang way more power. You have access to money and resources to buy guns, to be extravagant, to actualize the persona of being a big shot, the clothes, the jewelry. The gang, and the violence required to be in it, is made far more attractive by the fact it controls one of the few profitable industries in the neighborhood. But when he was 16, Chino began to break one of the cardinal rules of dealing, one made famous by Biggie Smalls. Don't get high on your own supply. To understand, I had to go back with him to the start of his story. Chino had always, he told me, been puzzled by one thing about his mother. Since she was openly a lesbian, how did she end up becoming pregnant? And by a cop, the species of man she had good reason to loathe the most. He found out the answer when he was 13. He explained his confusion to his aunt, Rose, who then offered, coldly, a story. In 1980, Chino's mother, Deborah, was raped by his father, Victor. Deborah was a black crack addict. Victor was a white NYPD officer, there to arrest her. So Chino is a child of the drug war in the purest sense. He was conceived on one of its battlefields. Chino had already known the vague outlines of his mother's life. He constructed a story that strung together his own fragmented memories of her and the hushed conversations he overheard from his relatives. Deborah was abandoned by her biological mother in the hospital as soon as she was born. Perhaps because her mother was herself a drug addict, soon to be sent to prison. The baby was adopted by a distant relative, Lucille Hardin, an old and old-school southern black woman who had come to New York from South Carolina and earned her living making brassieres. Mrs. Hardin didn't talk much about her childhood in the segregated South, except to say proudly that she never said yes'm to any white man, and that she worked on the assembly lines in World War II to save her country. Lucille Hardin raised Deborah as her own child, adoring her and spoiling her as if she were a little doll. But the word in the family was that at some point in her adolescence, Deborah was kidnapped by a group of men and gang-raped. She was never quite the same again. Nobody seems to know the details of it, or when she started soothing the pain it caused with the jab of a needle and the numbing of heroin. Mrs. Hardin paid for Deborah to go to rehab a few times, but nothing worked for long. She was sunk far enough into addiction to catch the first wave of crack in the early 1980s. Deborah would break in and take anything she could to get her next fix from the local gangsters. Her adopted mother would frequently have to call the police on her. It was on one occasion, when Deborah was 22 and in her mother's house, that Victor showed up. Long after, China will describe this, the night of his conception, with a controlled anger.